Will the wall come tumbling down? I just received on Tuesday an article from WorldNet Daily entitled Temple Mount Wall Said Nearing Collapse. And the Israelis have hired some Jordanians, a Jordanian engineering team, which has been called in to repair the southern section bulge in this Jerusalem holy site, the wall. Now, a lot of you probably remember the big dig that we've talked about over the years. My father helped sponsor that through Ambassador College in connection with Professor Benjamin Mazar, whom I've met many times. We sent hundreds of our students over there, both from all of the colleges, Brickett Wood, Big Sandy, and Pasadena. And it was right outside the very area where this wall is bulging now. And it is a 100-foot-long bulge that is protruding out about 3 feet. Now, above it is nearly 37 acres of where the Dome of the Rock is right in the middle, and off to one side is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and these are the third and fourth, or the second and third. I don't know how the Islamic people exactly rate them, and what that means I don't know anyway, but the second and third, I think, holiest sites to the Islamic religion on the face of the earth. The Jews, of course, believe that the Dome of the Rock is sitting squarely over ancient Mount Moriah, or the place of the near sacrifice of Isaac, and Abraham's final testing. Also, they believe that it's really the foundational stone of the earth. They believe it is the site of the ancient Garden of Eden, that Adam and Eve were right there in what is today Palestine, at the very beginning of human history. Since it was a Jewish holy site, and of course you know that the Solomonic Temple was built there, which was splendiferous to the point that it took the breath of the Queen of Sheba when she saw it, was later on destroyed by the Babylonians, and then a second temple was built during the Herodian period, which was destroyed in 70 AD by the armies of Titus. Over the last 25 or 30 years, there have been extensive explorations and archaeological excavations right next to that southern wall. Now, whoever comes near it, be he Muslim or Jew, is immediately blamed by the other parties as doing something which is going to cause the collapse, because they all know that various Jewish sects, and among them I think one of the leading ones that really is heard from more often than any other, is the Temple Mount faithful under Gershon Salomon, who stages every year at about the Feast of Tabernacles a symbolic trip around 7 times with a flatbed truck and a huge big stone, which he wants to lay as a symbolic cornerstone. And this is complete with priests wearing their priestly garments and blowing shofars and with an anointing ceremony of the stone. But the police keep them away, and they're not allowed to go up to what is called Harm el Sharif in the Arabic or the Temple Mount. More riots have broken out from that place than any place you can imagine. It was back when, because Israel actually has sovereignty over the entire area, and Jerusalem is what they call their eternal capital, even though, you know, Yasser Arafat and the PA is claiming Jerusalem as well, and there's tremendous conflict over Jerusalem and whether or not the Israelis are ever going to give in and allow them to have the old city, that is the Arabs and the PA, and them just stay in what is called the new city, which is now very old indeed. But be that as it may, there are charges and countercharges about anyone that dares touch that temple. So obviously, the Israeli government asked Jordanian engineers, who are Islamic, to come over and to repair the wall. I want to read just a portion of this article to you. Just from last Tuesday, while the holiest site in Judaism, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, is collapsing, Israel is waiting for Jordanian engineers to repair it. A group of Jordanian engineers is due to arrive in Jerusalem next week to repair a large bulge in the 37-acre Temple Mount southern wall. The Temple Mount is the foundation of the Jewish temple that was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans. Because it is the only remnant of the foundation, it is considered the holiest site for observant Jews. Now, this is not the portion that is called the Wailing Wall. It's around the corner from there on the south edge, which is just above Gina, or the Valley of Hinnom and the Brook Kidron. Perhaps the only true holy site, that is for Jews. Muslim claim it as the third holiest. Oh, third. I wasn't sure if it was the second or the third and fourth, but it's the third. They rate them that way. because the two mosques were constructed on the site hundreds of years later. Keep that in your mind, because I'm going to come back with the interview with Gershom Salomon and tell you a few things about that practice. What was a minor bulge 2 years ago on the south wall is widened to more than 100 feet and protrudes more than 3 feet. Meanwhile, a new bulge has developed on the west wall, just to the right of the Wailing Wall. Dark moisture stains suggest that water is seeping from a garden above that is creating pressure on the wall. You see, if you were to see the topography or the terrain there, you've got to envision a pinnacle of a rock that comes up very high. And then right across it, a 37-acre area, like a huge big pavement of stone, part of which is supported by columns and arches underneath in the part on the south part, which is called Solomon's Stables, where Solomon actually had horses and chariots and so on. Now, the Islamic people under the PA and what is called the Waqf, it's hard to pronounce, W-A-K-F, and they are a group of Islamic clerics who have had control over that area for a long time, but after the PA was established, then members of Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority have worked over them, and so the Waqf is sort of shot through with some of the PA people as well. And anyone who does anything there in any manner, shape, or form is accused of doing something to try to destroy it. The Muslims the world over know that the Jews want to see those great big mosques come down and build the third temple. That the Jews believe that with all of their being. When we come to it, we'll see that there are prophecies that strongly suggest that maybe that is going to occur, and that that is one of the major things that has to happen prior to the second coming of Christ. The Jews view it from an Old Testament standpoint, and we'll get to that in a little bit as well. Now, when the present prime minister, based upon the fact that the Waqf had absolutely not allowed any Jew, or even a Christian, to go near it. Now, when we were there in 1966, we were taken by an Arab guide, took our shoes off, went inside the mosque, the Dome of the Rock, actually looked down into the subterranean part that they have hollowed out in that pinnacle of rock where they claim Muhammad descended to heaven. And here were Islamic women down there praying, and we're walking around in our stocking feet, and we could see partway down there. So they had actually excavated directly beneath that gilded dome an area down into the solid stone where they descend down and they touch the stone and they pray there, and they believe that's where Muhammad went to heaven. Well, when Ariel Sharon, with heavy police protection, decided to stage a symbolic visit to the area, just to mount the steps past the Tomb of David, past the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and get up on top, as he did with a group of his entourage and heavily guarded by soldiers, a huge uprising, a giant riot took place, and the second Intifada, or uprising, and the boycott of all Israeli businesses by all of the Palestinians, which really hurt the Palestinians more than it does the Israelis, because thousands of them have lost jobs where they would go back and forth daily from Gaza or the West Bank or Hebron or wherever into the Israeli portions for a job. But now they don't even do that, and they haven't for a better part of what? A couple of years. And thousands have died as a result of all of this. So just because he went up there, even though it is sovereign Israeli territory, these people rose in absolute violence. I want to tell you a little more of this and then show you something interesting. The team of the engineers is currently choosing the proper material to fill the voids and cracks in a wall and will start work within a week. Now, that's right now. This is the last Tuesday that this article came out. Said Dr. Raif Najim, vice president of the state-run Jordanian Construction Committee. Despite the fact that the Temple Mount is the only real estate in the world that is revered by Jews, Israel has turned over the day-to-day administration of the area to the Waqf. It's hard to say, Waqf. An Islamic trust with close ties to Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority. A year-long dispute between Israel and the Waqf over who will fix the bulge was solved in October with a decision to involve the Jordanian engineers who inspected and took a sampling of the protruding wall, according to the Jerusalem Post. The majority of the work is to be done by the engineers who have consulted with various European firms to determine the best new binding materials and chemical additives, and will not take more than 10 days. The decision to let the Jordanians do the work, which was made at a meeting chaired by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, follows repeated warnings by top Israeli archaeologists that sections of the southern wall are in danger of collapse. And then, as Newsweek magazine said, calling the wall the Armageddon Wall, because the old rocks help support an enormous stone platform that holds up the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. They speculate, what if some Arab holy day occurs and thousands upon thousands of Arabs are up there walking around and add their weight to this structure and it collapses and hundreds of them die? Guess who is going to get blamed? Not the Jordanian engineers. And so it's fascinating at what is going on right now in Jerusalem. It makes you wonder what is going to happen in the future. I want to show you something, and I'll put it out. Maybe we can have it here on the platform afterward. If you'll be very careful with it, you can look through it. I don't know if Mark can zoom in enough to get this or not, and I'll page through it. If he can, I'll do it. The Odyssey of the Third Temple. You can see this is a fabulous book. This is produced by a group that is actually in Jerusalem, but has heavy support here in the United States. And they are not the Temple of the Mount Faithful under Gershon Solomon, but the Institute of the Temple, or the Temple Institute. This is their version of, and it may be pretty accurate, the Ark of the Covenant. As you can see by the book, it is a desktop-type book. It has all kinds of colorful illustrations in the back, including some of the most beautiful of the vessels that were used in temple worship. And I'm going to put it here, and if you'll be very careful with it, thank you. You may be able to just page through it and just look at it briefly after the services. I want to show you something else that is of special interest to me that I brought. I'll be very careful the way I handle it. This little bottle, little jar, used to be on a little kind of a, either a niche in a wall or on a little support that holds it. This came from the excavations at the dig right by the southern wall. It was used by a family that lived in a private home just within a few hundred feet of the temple during the Herodian period. It is over 2,000 years of age, and this little bottle was in a private home near which Jesus and the disciples had to walk at some time or another because they frequented the environs of the temple time and time again. This was given to me by Professor Mazar when I visited over there in Israel at the dig, and of course many hundreds of artifacts, partial things such as this, but this is a perfectly preserved specimen of a little clay jug that probably contained olive oil. And what they would do, instead of having a flat-bottomed one, which would not work, they would actually put a little niche in a kind of a plaster, and they would set it in the little niche. That's the way they did their great big wine jugs and all the rest of it. So I'll probably just keep this. I won't let people handle it necessarily, but I wanted to show it to you because it was given to me as a gift by Professor Mazar, and I appreciate it. It's been in my study ever since. So whenever I look at it, it reminds me of how old I am. That is over 2,000 years of age, and it's been around a long time. Well, will a temple soon be built in Jerusalem? That's the title of a brochure I wrote a long time ago. And it is possible that something accidental could come about to cause a collapse. But on the other hand, there are many who want to see those mosques either bulldozed down or blown up or burnt, as one man tried to do many years ago, an Australian, who actually was a person who received the Plain Truth magazine. And for all I know, he may be a member of the ICG in Australia. I don't know. I haven't heard from him for many, many years, but he was a member of the Worldwide Church of God. And he was arrested, and I don't know how much time he spent in prison, but he was eventually let go. And he was trying to bring about the fulfillment of prophecy because he firebombed the Al-Aqsa Mosque. That happened, I think, back in the 70s, perhaps, but I forget the date. It's a long time ago. If you'll turn to Haggai 1, verses 1 to 14, let me tell you that the Jews, who of course rejected Jesus Christ as their Messiah ben David, as they say, or their Messiah, believe that all of these prophecies relate to them today, and that it is incumbent upon these Jewish sects to obey what these prophecies say. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Eternal by Haggai, the prophet, unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh the Eternal of hosts, saying, This people say, The time is not come, the time that the Eternal's house should be built. Then came the word of the Eternal by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now time out for another aside. I received a very lengthy email this morning from Hurley Bumgardner, who had had it sent to him from someone in Pasadena. And there is a lengthy article where the worldwide people have once more met with committees from the city and with city officials and are saying that unless someone buys the auditorium, it's going to be subjected to the bulldozers and the wrecking ball because they will not be able to keep it up. They don't have, now think of this, here is an organization that took a huge church from about $220 million a year down to such an impoverished condition that it cannot afford $174,000 a year for the maintenance of that magnificent building. When my dad wanted to build that building, he said he wanted to do it for $10 million. I'll never forget what took place in his suite in Tel Aviv when I went to him and said, Dad, if you're going to borrow $10 million, let me just build 10 regional centers outside the major places where we have big churches all over the country on a scale like Ambassador College in Big Sandy with a field house, with an auditorium. We could even build schools around them. And for $1 million apiece, and that was way, way back in about 1969 or 70, 71, we can do an awful lot. Well, he said that he would, and he agreed with that. A couple of hours later, he called me in my room. He said, Ted, come back up to my suite, if you would. I came back up. He said, Ted, I've hit on how we can do both what you are proposing and build the auditorium. I will send out a letter that will so inspire the people that they will give twice as much money, and we'll be able to do both of those things. I think that was one of the rare times when I cried like a whipped baby. I said, Dad, you just can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. I begged him not to do it, and I had tears in my eyes when I spoke. I was trembling. I was shocked. I was just absolutely devastated. Didn't want him to do it. Well, make a long story short, the building ended up costing $23 million. It only seated about 1,200 and some people. I would have built one for a third the cost that would have seated three or four times that number of people, but I wouldn't have had gold gilt and a huge wall of onyx and all of that in it. Now, that's another story, but I wanted to put that on the record before I'm long gone, so at least it will survive me and someone will know the truth about what happened during those days, because it was pretty traumatic. Now, to my point. It's a matter of archives, and I would imagine that the Reeses and other people and the Vances who have saved letters from those days can go back and prove to you that letter after letter after letter from my father called that a house for God. I took great issue with that because of what Isaiah said, Where is the house that you will build unto me? And where is the place of my dwelling, saith the Eternal? But my father told the membership, This is a house for God. And those are the exact words that he used. Not a house of God, a house for God. And so the constituency, the membership of the church, almost looked upon it as a holy site. They almost looked upon it as a religious site. But in practical fact, it became a commercial auditorium. And they had all of the great musicians. I mean, I could stand here and name them one after another. The greatest pianist, the greatest guitarist, the greatest vocalist, Beverly Sill. I got a picture right in there in my office of me standing there at the party after Beverly Sill sang in one of those things. He brought the entire Viennese Philharmonic Symphony over there and mass and their director for the opening event of that auditorium. Flew them all the way to Pasadena. It was unbelievable. The acoustics were so perfect that you could stand there and talk in a normal voice and a person in the furthest part of the balcony could hear you perfectly. Some of the greatest operatic singers would sing without any microphone and everybody could hear them in the farthest corner of the room. And they would go away talking about how wonderful that auditorium was. Well, Mr. Joe Bauer was chosen, a very good friend of mine. He was the director of the television program at that time, to direct the auditorium. And so it became arranged almost like a commercial business. Top Hollywood stars were there. I think it led indirectly to Bing Crosby's death, because I was there the night when Bing Crosby, after many, many takes all day long, and they had built an artificial set, and we had in the front of the auditorium a three-way huge portion of the stage where the whole stage with the orchestra sitting there could disappear before your eyes. It could go down to the third level down below where everything was stored, could come up to another level where there were a lot of rooms underneath for practice and all of that, and then come up to the stage level. And they had put that all the way down to the bottom, and Bing, with the lights in his face and being exhausted, didn't know it. And he was just so exhausted, he's going to turn and get off the stage. He's supposed to go to his right. And he took a step and just plummeted over 30 feet onto the concrete. I didn't see him fall, but I heard people scream, and a portion of the set came down and hit the guy on the head sitting next to me and lacerated his scalp. Blood is pouring. What is going on? Everybody is saying, he fell. Oh, so I rushed down there and got there just in time as Bob Hope got there. And Bob Hope was cursing a blue streak. And a doctor, I'll never forget, came there realizing what could happen. Gave me a wooden dollar, and it had his address and name on it, kind of a lighthearted thing that I guess he gave to people. He said, if you need me, I'm right here. I saw it all. And he was the fellow that first got there to investigate how bad Bing Crosby was hurt. And he knew that there could be legal action as a result of this. It scared me because I thought, well, that's the end of the church, the end of the auditorium, the end of everything else. I mean, if Bing Crosby dies as a result of this. We had people, I mean, all kinds of movie stars were there that night. We went over and I sang to them all. We got a band out there and have a big dance. And about every 20 minutes, I'm making an announcement that comes from the hospital about Bing Crosby and how he is doing. Well, as you know, he survived that. He lived another couple of years or so. He recovered well enough to be able to play golf and all of that. But you see, for years, the auditorium was run like a commercial venture. But here's the point. Think about it. What do you think you have to pay to get some of the top artists in the world, the greatest singers, the greatest violinists, the greatest pianists, the greatest opera singers, and so on, to perform in a 1,200-seat auditorium? What do you think the ticket charge would be to be able to have a huge staff to pay all the bills for it, a big building, tremendous lighting and all of that? So the point is that it was a white elephant the minute it was opened up if you're going to try to run it as a commercial venture, because it would have had to have seated 5,000 people to even break even. So they can't keep it, and it's absolutely disgusting beyond belief, because there is documented evidence that 150 or 200,000 people were told over and over again, this is a house for God. And right there in great big golden letters on a huge onyx wall is a dedication, it says, to the great God. It's right there on the front wall of the auditorium. And these people that inherited, if that's the term to use, that's a polite term, the worldwide church and all those magnificent properties are going to wreck or destroy that building. Makes me wonder, it's not only about the moral issue, but it makes me wonder about the legal issue as to whether or not, but I've given up long ago that there are any people in the worldwide church in the last 25 years that have had the stamina or have had the strength or however you want to put it to be able to stand up to those people and to do what is necessary to prevent them from doing what they did to that organization. All right. That became almost like a dream trip for thousands of God's people. And one of my arguments to Dad was, Dad, you know, you're not going to have any bricks there with their names on it. 90-some percent of the people who are supporting this thing are never even going to be able to see it. And here we've got Big Sandy with Imperial School, Pasadena with Imperial School, Brigittwood with Imperial School. And those people pay school board taxes, and they pay local and state and county taxes, and they tithe first tithe, second tithe, and every third year a third tithe even though they saved the second tithe for themselves. And then we have a building fund which is over and beyond all of the other things so that this can be built. And I said, wouldn't it be better if some of that money went back to the regions from which it came and that we did something for the people for a change? It sounded logical to me, but then I think that I'm a logical person. Well, I got nowhere with it. And as I see what is happening now, a deep sadness comes over me about that entire chapter of my life and of what happened back then. And I read that just this morning, and it's just impossible for me not to comment about it. All right, enough of that. Then came the word of the Eternal by Haggai the prophet, saying, "Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus says the Eternal of hosts, consider your ways. You've sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus says the Eternal of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, says the Eternal." Have you ever seen a cedar of Lebanon? If you've seen pictures of the magnificent front lawn of the Memorial Hall at Ambassador College Brigham Wood, it was flanked by huge cedars of Lebanon. And they've got great big trunks. They look like a deodar, if you know what that is. They look like a type of a conifer, which is an evergreen. But they grow with a huge trunk. They tend to be fairly short, but they have branches that go out in sort of a flat manner. And they are about the most beautiful tree on the face of the earth. But their wood is cedar, and of course is very weather resistant, very long lasting, and can be polished to a high sheen. And so cedars of Lebanon were used in a building of the temple, both the first and the second temple, as a matter of fact. And so that's why he said to go up to the mountain and to bring wood, and he would take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified. You looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why? Meaning a drought. Said the Eternal of hosts, because mine house it is waste, and you run every man into his own house. Therefore, the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. The way Gershon, Solomon, and many of these people take this in Israel, and the Jews who support these organizations in the United States, is that a lot of the ongoing violence and the problems is because they are displeasing God. And Gershon Solomon says that over and over again. I'm going to read portions of the interview that my son Mark had with him some years ago, which I got out of our website and had sent to me, and I have it right here. I won't read it all because it's very, very lengthy. But it's in that booklet, Will a Temple Soon Be Built in Jerusalem, which is published on a website, and which, if you haven't read, it was published some years ago, and you can get a copy. Therefore, the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. And I called for a drought upon the land, and upon the mountains, and upon the corn, and upon the new wine, and upon the oil, and upon that which the ground bringeth forth, and upon men and cattle, and upon the labors of the hands. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Eternal their God, and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Eternal their God had sent him, and the people did fear before the Eternal. It's interesting that there was Moses and Aaron. There was Elijah and Elisha. There was Zerubbabel and Joshua. And there are going to be the two witnesses. And where will the two witnesses dwell? Where will they work? Where will they sleep at night? They're going to be in Jerusalem for 3.5 years. Where do they go after they've had an audience with a beast and a false prophet? Where did Moses and Aaron go? Did they lie down at night? Did they have a place? Was there somewhere to which they could resort? Well, of course, human beings. It's going to be interesting to see, isn't it, whether a temple will be built. Now, there were buildings all around the temple for the priests. And when you see the replicas, and they are available in Jerusalem, and this book has pictures of the whole city, the whole area there, showing Robinson's Arch and all of it, and that there were all kinds of quarters right there for the priests. As far as I know, that little vessel that I showed you could have belonged to a priestly family. It could have been someone who lived and worked in the temple itself, because it would have been as close to the temple as I am to that wall. I'm talking about a very small area, it wasn't many, many acres, of an archaeological dig that went right down to the Herodian pavement and the Herodian period, and all of these very astute archaeologists knew exactly which layer of rubble that they were going through, and unearthed all of these things, and of course there were dates on the coins that they discovered so they could prove beyond the shadow of a doubt where they were. Now it's interesting to wonder about that time in Jerusalem, because there will apparently be another temple built. When are they going to commence? How do they start? How can they begin to build a temple so long as those two mosques are there? What would happen in the entire Islamic world if the mosques were somehow torn down, blown up, bulldozed, or taken apart piece by piece, transported to Mecca, and reconstructed, as Gershon Salomon proposes, as I'll come to a little later on? But there could be some very big events, and maybe the war in the Middle East, which is about to break out and may happen in January, at the latest, I think, February, because of the weather factor. George Bush said just the other day they are in material breach. We now are having as many as 50,000 over there, and all the big aircraft carriers and all the forces are gathering, and all the signs are that the war that we've been expecting for months could literally break out at almost any moment. So we will see. But I speculate. Scuds are notoriously inaccurate. What if a scud came right down through the dome on the Dome of the Rock and exploded? It'd be interesting, fascinating, if Saddam Hussein destroyed the third holiest or the fourth holiest or the second holiest site in all of his religion, but who would get blamed? They'd claim the Jews had put a bomb inside. That's what they would say, even if they saw the scud coming out of the skies. That's going to be fascinating in these next months and years to see what happens in Jerusalem, which is the focal point of the Bible, of biblical history, and of all of biblical prophecy. So, look at the last verse of that section. The Eternal stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and did work in the house of the Eternal of hosts their God. Now look at chapter 2, 4 through 9. Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel meant one born in Babylon. And it's significant in a sense because Christ says, come out of this world. So here is a person who was born in the world of Babylon, Babylonish captivity, but yet is used to build the temple of God. And be strong, O Joshua, son of Josedek, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, says the Eternal, and work. For I am with you, says the Eternal of hosts. You can apply that to the work of God. Be strong and work. God's command says, 6 days shalt thou work, and the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. The world doesn't believe any of that anymore, let alone the Sabbath. They don't believe the first part of the command, that people ought to work. Look how many people are frantically spending money on the Powerball, and they got one chance out of something like 221 million, and they think it's going to hit me. They would be actually, a bolt of lightning striking them dead, sitting in their favorite chair, is more likely to happen than somebody winning that Powerball. And right now it's in the news because there's a huge gambling furor and fever in the United States, and somebody wants to win 200 and some million dollars. He said, I am with you according to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remains among you. Fear ye not. For thus says the Eternal of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. That's the Messiah. And I will fill this house with glory, says the Eternal of hosts. Look at the vision that is in the minds of these Jews who are completely deceived, never accepted Christ, and they read scriptures like this. And to them, the entire future history of the Jewish race and the Jewish people is all bound up in the building of the temple, because they say that Messiah won't come or can't come until the temple is built. And if and when the temple is built, then all the glorious promises about bringing the diaspora back, I will regather you, I will be among you, I will be your God, you will be my people, and the whole world will be blessed in you, and so on. They believe all of those things in the immediate future. They don't look at this as Old Testament history. They look at it as a command from God to build the temple. Now, the Israeli government does not. And they don't allow these various Jewish sects to have anything to do with it or to even approach it. And so they have to stay over on the outside perimeter and take their flatbed truck and the stone and go around it seven times, symbolic. Maybe they're hoping a wall will come tumbling down. It did at Jericho. They're blowing the shofars, and they have that symbolic march every Feast of Tabernacles. Now, he says, I will fill this house with glory. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former. So we're not talking about the Herodian temple here. We're talking about, this is a prophecy about the end time temple. Will a temple be built in Jerusalem? Is this prophecy relating to the temple that was built during Herodian, which was still there during the Herodian period, but was built shortly after the Babylonian captivity? Well, this didn't happen then. The glory of this latter house shall be greater than that of the former? It was not. The Herodian temple was very inferior to Solomon's temple. And I, in this place, will I give peace. Now that prophecy has certainly not come to pass in Jerusalem, has it? There's no peace over there. Now I'll turn to 2 Thessalonians 2, and I think you're all aware of this prophecy, but I'll just remind those who might not be that familiar with it. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit, by word, nor by letters from us, that the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means, any manner or method. For that day shall not come except there come a falling away first. There's one way that I could look at that and say, that's already happened. I'm not going to be dogmatic about that, but I don't think a falling away means Baptists becoming Catholics. Do you? I don't think it means, First Church of Christ and the Presbyterian Church going and groveling before the Pope. I don't think that's what it means. I think it means a falling away from the true Church of God. And the biggest falling away, the biggest departure that has ever occurred in the history of God's church, so far as I know, took place in the late 70s and the early 80s, when tens of thousands of people left and went back into Protestant churches or went back into the world and just didn't do anything. Now, a lot of them, gathered together and formed up to 250 different groups, but some of them have also gone into things like Pentecostalism and all that and so on. But the bulk of them, I think, stick to the broad parameters of the truth that they learned through the church at that time. So it certainly makes you speculate about the falling away. And that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. We know that the present day Pope is very near A, retirement, or B, death. He is extremely feeble. He barely gets around. He can barely mumble his words. There's been a lot of speculation, and I've written about it. I've seen all the various faces, all the people. There is one black man. There is a German that is very high on the list of those who might be the next pope. There are others, some other countries, including Africa, who are being tutored by some of the College of Cardinals, and don't think that the political behind-the-scenes maneuvering is not going on all the time in the College of Cardinals about who the next pope is going to be that will replace the present pope. And when he emerges, you better take a good long look at him, where he is from, who he is, what kind of a person will he be, what will his policies be, and it's going to be interesting because, depending upon his age, he could be the final one. Now, I'm not going to predict that he will choose the title Sixtus the Sixth, because that doesn't say 666 anyway, but the fact that in history there were five who took the title Sixtus, and that there could be one that would be Sixtus the Sixth, is at least intriguing, if nothing else. Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sits in the temple of God. Now, there's a background behind that it would take me 4 hours to tell you. But like a pseudo-Christ, what if this man actually comes because people have actually said the best way for world troubles to be solved is to have the Pope parachute right down in the midst? And I've had fun with that in the past. It's a bird, it's a plane, it's a Pope. And that people had actually said they ought to just go there, right in the middle of the big battle, and just hold it, everybody, because there'd be a lot of Catholics there and so on, and that they ought to get together all the holy men, you know, the top mullahs in Iran and maybe the top mullahs in Iraq and the top Jewish rabbis and the greatest American evangelists and just put all these religious people in there, and that would solve all these wars and all these troubles. But now, on a serious note, since the false prophet, who is this person right here, the man of sin, is going to be in collusion with the beast, who is going to be at the head of a huge agglomeration of at least 10 nations, and you know a king can rule over more than one political entity, whether 15 or 25 doesn't matter, it does say 10 kings, and there is going to be a vast army that is going to move into the Middle East, and this man will be ensconced where? In the temple of God. Now, Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in about 54 AD. So it was another 16 years before the temple would be destroyed, and the temple still stood. Paul could not have meant the church as an analogy, or he would have said so. He said the temple of God, and the word temple is the very same word used elsewhere for the temple of God. And so he meant temple of God. Paul didn't know that the Romans were going to destroy the temple in 70 AD. He was dead by then. He died probably a year or two before the sack and the pillage of Jerusalem in Roman imprisonment, and probably was thrown into the Colosseum and was attacked by wild animals. But he died in the late 60s AD. Now, he says in 2 Thessalonians 2:7 to 11, "For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now lets," meaning restrains, "will continue to restrain until he be taken out of the way." And then that has two possible meanings, until Paul be removed or until ginomai, the Greek word, which is until it become to be or it become evident for what it is, which is the preferred one in my mind. "And then shall that wicked one," says the margin, "be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." So this is a human being, a religious leader, taking the arrogant title, the blasphemous title of God, and people are worshiping him, just like they did Herod, you know, who was eaten up of worms. People worshiped the Caesars and called them divine. They approached him and said, "How are you today, divinity?" Absolute blasphemy. And this man is going to claim to be God, but he'll have the power of Satan, the devil, to perform miracles and, quote, "cause that the image of the beast should both speak and cause them that would not worship the image of the beast to be killed." Nebuchadnezzar got an idea from his dream. Daniel interpreted the dream when he said, "The gold, the head of gold, it is thou, O king, because you are a king of kings." Nebuchadnezzar thought, "I know. I'll erect a giant image that is me and put it out in the plain of Babylon, and I'll cause everybody to bow down to it as an idol to worship, in sense, me." Well, then you know the story of the so-called three holy children. So I've always wondered, since there is a great church on this earth that really specializes in bleeding, weeping, and speaking images, that maybe there will be a gigantic image made in the form of the individual who will be the great false prophet of that time, and maybe with the power of Satan, just like going behind the screen in the movie that they've been running again on television here lately, where Judy Garland goes to find where the Wizard of Oz really is, behind the curtain, and a lot of witchcraft and wizardry and that, and I don't recommend it. But anyway, maybe the image will speak. Maybe people will get their orders from the image, not from a man. That's going to be fascinating to find out if something like that occurs. "Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and all signs and lying wonders, but all deceivables of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth that they might be saved, and for this cause God will send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie." The bulk of humanity believes in lies. The bulk of the adherents of almost every major religion believe in lies. And almost all politicians believe in lies and promulgate lies. Will the Ark of the Covenant ever be discovered? Some people claim it has already been discovered. That's utter nonsense. It would be the most incredible thing. It would electrify the entire Jewish world. It would immediately be an object of reverence and of worship beyond anything you've ever seen. So you can forget the cheap little paper tracts and pamphlets you may have seen that some guy claims he discovered somewhere the Ark of the Covenant. It's nonsense. It hasn't happened. Let me give you something out of the Talmud. In Tractate Yoma, that's a section of the Talmud, it explains that as King Solomon built the temple, he already knew through divine inspiration that eventually it would be destroyed. Therefore, he commanded that a special place be built in the bowels of the earth underneath the Temple Mount, where the sacred vessels of the temple could be hidden in case of approaching danger. It makes me wonder why they dug that hole in the rock. Did they dig the hole in the rock because they wanted women to go down there to touch the rock and worship? Or did the Muslims dig it for some other purpose? Now, it goes on to say that he would have it built in the bowels of the earth underneath the temple where the sacred vessels of the temple could be hidden in case of approaching danger. In this regard, Midrashic and Talmudic tradition teach that King Josiah of Israel, who lived about 40 years before the destruction, commanded the Levites to hide the Ark of the Testimony together with a menorah, you know, the seven pipes, the candles, the anointing oil, and other items in a secret hiding place which Solomon had prepared. 2 Chronicles 35, 1-3 says, "Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Eternal in Jerusalem, and they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. And he set the priests in their charges and encouraged them to the service of the house of the Eternal. And he said unto the Levites that taught all Israel, which were holy unto the Lord, put the holy ark in the house which Solomon the son of David, king of Israel, did build. It shall not be a burden upon your shoulders. Serve now the Eternal your God and his people Israel." It did disappear at the time of the Babylonian captivity. No one really knows where it went. It'll be interesting if it's ever discovered, because it would become the holiest artifact to the Jews. It would cause great devotion. And if it were discovered first, it gives the entire Jewish race urgent necessity to find a place to put it. Question. My son asked Gershon Solomon some years ago, "When was the Temple Mount Faithful Movement started?" Answer. The Temple Mount Faithful Movement was founded immediately after the Six-Day War, when the Israeli army, the heroes of the Israeli army, liberated the Temple Mount in Jerusalem after 2,000 years of the diaspora and the destruction of the Temple in Jerusalem, and the historical belief that the dreams of the Jewish and Israeli people were fulfilled. He goes on and on then about how Moshe Dayan, who, of course, at that time had the power to do it, gave the control of the Temple Mount shortly after the Israelis had liberated it back into the hands of the Muslims, and the Waqf has had it ever since. And he took great issue to that. He, Moshe Dayan, whom I have met and spent the afternoon in his home, gave back the Temple Mount to the enemies of yesterday and the enemies of tomorrow. Question. But Israel still controls this section of the city, still occupies it militarily. So in a sense, it has not really been completely returned. It's just been allowed to be used for worship. Is that right? Answer. No. It is not exactly, because the day after the Six-Day War, the gates of the Temple Mount were closed to Jews who wanted to come to this very holy place, this most holy place to the Jews. The gates were closed before the Jews. They were not allowed to pray. Jews can pray today in New York, London, and Paris, Tokyo, and every place, even in the Red Square in Moscow. But not in the most holy place, the only one most holy place of the Jewish people, on the Temple Mount. Question. And that's up on top of the Wailing Wall where the Dome of the Rock sits? Answer. Yes. The Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall, is not for us so holy. It represents a memory of the diaspora, the destruction, the land of Israel. The Jews were thrown out from the Temple Mount and they prayed here because they had not another choice. But in our hearts, our feelings, everything in our life is up on the Temple Mount. To us, the Arab occupation of 1,300 years, which was made by an Arab colonialism coalition, when they, the Temple Mount of the second century, they built a mosque. Now listen to this. And the Dome of the Rock, on the place of the temple, as you can see it just now. They did it in many other countries which they occupied in imperialistic occupation. In Istanbul, they changed the church, which was the eastern center of Eastern Christianity. They built, in a very holy place for Christians, a mosque. And they did it in Spain. And they did it in North Africa. And in the Balkans. Every place. to give legitimization to the Arab imperialistic occupation of those countries. They did the same thing on the Temple Mount. You must know that Arab occupation of the Temple Mount was finished after the Six-Day War, and the memories of this Arab imperialistic occupation of the Temple Mount must be finished. It went on and on and on, about five pages. Toward the end of it, Mark asked him, "So you're saying that in order to fulfill your movement's goals, the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque would have to be destroyed to make room for the building of the Third Temple?" Answer: not destroyed. We are not barbarians. No, the Arabs, they occupied Jerusalem before the war. They destroyed all the synagogues. We are not barbarians. What we're saying, we shall, by the will of God, we shall dismantle very carefully, with a very big respect, those two buildings, the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and rebuild them again in the right place, Mecca. Big events may be in the offing. This week, in the next few days, Jordanian engineers begin to try to correct the bulge in the wall. It makes you wonder, will the wall come tumbling down?